This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Welcome to Spoken Nerd, Criticism in Conversation at the Wheeler Centre. My name is Bhakti Puvanantharan. I'm a journalist at The Age and I'll be your host today. And I have to warn you that I listened to the Slate Culture Gabfest Abstract Nouns edition from a few years ago, which is a terrible one to listen to before preparing for this. It's an episode about the nature of conversation. So I'm now highly self-conscious about speaking in any way.
Well, that's what we're there for.
So we're here today meeting in a place we call Melbourne, but it was known as Narm for many, many years before that. And I respectfully acknowledge that this is the land of the traditional land of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to their elders, past and present, and elders from other communities who may be here today. So I know many of you are on your lunch hour, so we'll get to the good stuff very quickly. So on our panel today, at the end is Cerise Howard, co-host of film show Plato's Cave on 3RRR Radio, and it's also a weekly podcast. And Cerise is also the artistic director of the Czech and Slovak Film Festival. Is that right?
That is correct.
Oh, great. Okay, and moving along, Stephen Metcalf is critic at large for Slate and co-host of Slate Culture Gabfest. He has a book that he's working on about the 1980s that is due.
Many have asked that question.
I'm going to ask Cerise about the origins of the name Plato's Cave in ancient philosophy. It's due out in the next
1980,
century or so.
The next 80s.
Yeah.
2080, yeah. It's about the 2080s.
Mel Campbell is co-host of the Rereaders podcast, and she also has a romantic comedy novel out, co-authored by Anthony Morris, called The Hot Guy. It's a great name. And immediately to my left, Dana Stevens, who's a movie critic for Slate and co-host of the Culture Gabfest. And she has a book coming out next year on Buster Keaton and the 20th century. Please make them all very welcome. Now, it's very exciting to have the Slate Culture Gabfest team here in Australia. This was a show that was at the nucleus of the podcasting Big Bang, if you like, about a decade ago. And forgive the metaphor, but it's an explosion that we now know is creating multiverses unto itself. And, of course, there are, aside from podcasting, there are many other ways of criticism that we imbibe, from the traditional review to email newsletters, Twitter, review aggregation sites. And like so many other genres, there's more criticism now than perhaps there's ever been before, which is thrilling and also dizzying. So I'm going to start by asking everyone a bit about the origin story of their podcast, how it came to be, and any other kind of little nuggets of back when.
All right, I start?
Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe Steve and I can sort of do this together. We should beatbox on it because he was there. And in fact, if anything, Stephen was at the origin more than I was, because the Slate Culture Gabfest came about as kind of a sister to the Slate Political Gabfest. I think they started 10 years ago. We started 9 years ago. And that really was, as you say, kind of at the dawn of podcasting time. And the idea was really, I mean, I think when Stephen came up with the idea with the executive producer of Slate Podcasts, Andy Bowers, that there were so many political chat shows out there, many of which are modeled after a very familiar TV idea of political chat shows, and there just wasn't really anything in the culture domain that was comparable. So, Steve, maybe you can take it from there and say, you know, what did you think needed to be out in the universe that wasn't?
Yeah, is your book really coming out in 2018?
According to my contract.
Oh my God.
I hope my editor's not listening to Bhakti right now.
So the original idea is just as Dana said, was to, I mean, it was a kind of niche no one knew needed to be filled, and maybe they still don't. But the, you know, the essential idea was to, I think there were two ideas in addition to what Dana said. The first was that. What were the two ideas? The first was that you have this kind of cadre of super or kind of hyper-educated people who've gone through culture studies programs over the last 20 or 30 years and have imbibed a lot of literary and critical theory and have a way of talking about culture that really can be clicked into action regardless of whether you're talking about something high, low, or middle, and in fact kind of thrives on collapsing those distinctions. And those people are chronically underemployed. And you have to give them something to do now that the study of the humanities has collapsed completely. And so the idea was to create a show in which, you know, three people engaged at kind of any level of discourse. I mean, we certainly go low ourselves, but, you know, to talk in an elevated way about low things and talk in a low way about elevated things, I think was partially our original remit. But Dana, what do you want to add to that?
I think that was still just one thing. So I want to hear the second
thing.
I know,
because I've completely forgotten what the second one was.
It'll come to you. Mel, can you tell us about how the Rereaders came to be?
Sure. Well, the Rereaders began in Sydney. It was founded by Sam Twyford Moore, who's a writer and arts curator and worker. And he basically was seeing a similar space. He was a great admirer of the Gadfest, so in many ways it's kind of a bit harsh that I'm the one on stage and not Sam. But anyway, then when Sam moved down here to Melbourne, he started up a new team for the Rereaders because it had originally been a Sydney podcast. And I was brought on board at the start of last year. And so now Sam has just left Rereaders after 7 years, so we're trying to figure out who we are now and what we do. But essentially, we do a rereading of things that are out, you know, a deep reading. And exactly like Stephen was saying, we try and provide a level of detailed analysis that it's hard to find elsewhere in the media.
Mm-hmm. How many of you are there on the show?
Oh, it seems embarrassing to point this out. There are three of us, and we have three topics each episode.
It just proves that Steve and Andy created a durable model. That's I'm proud of
yeah.
that.
I love it. I thought of the second thing, by the way.
How good.
Which is that, you know, why would you have a million different political chat shows? Why is there a bottomless appetite for that, for the minutiae of politics, the day-to-day minutiae of politics, when, especially living in the United States of America, culture and the culture industry are every bit as pervasive and determinative of our consciousness as politics are? I mean, you could even argue more so. And yet, there's this kind of tacit belief that you really don't or shouldn't process popular culture, especially through your own intellect, through your understanding, your conscious understanding. And so sort of bringing point one together with point two, with that, trying very hard not to sound like a completely out of touch snob, to treat things that are often just sort of accepted as part of the furniture of one's mental life, like the weekly release of a blockbuster movie, to treat it a little bit at arm's length and a little bit like a, I hate this phrase, but a little bit like a text. Right? And then with Julia Turner, who didn't go to graduate school, who's not a, you know, hyper-educated snob, with her there to keep us honest, right?
And she sure does that.
Yeah.
So, Reese, Plato's Cave was born as a podcast, but now is also live broadcast. Mm-hmm. And can you tell us a bit about what you as a founding member remember?
Oh, well, I'm not a founding member.
Oh, you're not a founding member.
No, I'm an interloper. I arrived late in the piece. The podcast was established by community radio station 3RRR in early 2011 by Thomas Caldwell, who's still with the show, Josh Nelson and Tara Judah, both of whom are overseas. But whose presences are still felt. And nowadays, slightly deviating from the composition of the podcast that have just been described across yours and yours, we actually have as many as four co-hosts. I know.
Contribution.
Slow it down for me.
Yeah.
Yes. So you add one person.
That's right. But often one of us is absent, as I was last night. So.
Okay, blow my mind, how many topics do you do?
Look, often as many as three.
And, but sometimes fewer than three.
Sometimes as few as three as well. Yeah. And typically they're films either in new release or in some sort of repertory screening, which are deemed of worthy of us really sinking our teeth into them and attacking them as, not exactly as a unit, because we differ sometimes wildly in our appreciation and perspectives on any given film or text. Other times we are in unison, but really we like to come at film, take the criticism of it seriously and yet still have a few laughs, but especially acknowledge that criticism needn't be a monolithic undertaking, that it needn't be the voice of a single person who is an arbiter of good taste somehow and pronounces things definitively. We acknowledge that there are multiple perspectives. And so we try to bring at least four of them, sometimes as few as three, to any given one on a Monday night when we go live, and then captured for posterity ever after. That's posterity for you. Podcast. So that's since 2011. I've been with the show since 2014 when it first went live to air.
So we've got a podcast of 9 years, a podcast of 7 years, and a podcast of 6 years, which is quite a long time in podcasting world. To continue the terrible metaphor, there are lots of shooting stars in the podcast world, right, that burn out pretty quickly. What keeps you coming back when you have so many other things on your table, like writing books and filing reviews and, writing novels?
Yeah. Oh, well, for me, I think the podcast provides a space to discuss the things that you're burning to talk about, but that can't find a place within the regular media. For instance, it's endlessly frustrating to me as a film critic that there are all these other competing film critics, because as you said, Bhakti, it's a golden age for criticism at the moment. There have never been more places to do it, but there are also very few places to do it and earn a living from it. Mm. So sometimes...
Right, from the consumer end, it's a golden age. From the producing end, it's a drought. Yeah.
Yeah. So, of course, sometimes I'll be reviewing films that I don't care very much about but I've been commissioned to write about. But the ones that I really have the passion for, I can talk about on the podcast. And also we can talk about weird sort of minutiae type things or weird just ideas that would be hard to place as an article or something in the regular media. What about you guys? What keeps you going?
Oh, I don't know if I have a satisfactory answer. It's a routine. It's Monday night. I go into the studio. I need to get out more. There are a community. I don't know. Is it ego? Maybe it is. Think people are listening.
I feel like I would say that doing the podcast with Steve and Julie every week is the kind of freest and most joyful part of my job.
Mm. You know, I mean, not that there's not joy in reviewing contemporary films, but there's a sense that whatever is there, you have to review it. There's less freedom in that way, right? Whatever the studios choose to release that week is what's on my table to write about. And with Steve and Julie and I mean, there might be, we'll talk about Wonder Woman here tomorrow night. So there might be a big blockbuster on our plate, but we also have the freedom to say, you know what, there's this meme that's really getting on my nerves and I just want to, look into it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can just take some piece of ephemera from pop culture that otherwise would go drifting by and either irritate us or delight us and then disappear take a moment to really plunge into it.
Right, I agree with that. Also, Andy, I have to say, Andy Bowers, the guy who basically created the program, had a stroke of genius when he insisted we end every show saying something positive about something that we cared about. So we end every show kind of endorsing something. Some cultural product that we've consumed from the previous week could be anything from an apple pie to a, essay by Ralph Waldo Emerson. But I would say that there's, for me personally, the reason I come back to it is there's that kind of warm, vaguely euphoric feeling when the beating stops. And that's what it's like. That's what it's like to not write. And whatever else is true about doing the Culture Gap Fest, it is not writing.
That's right.
And I just
amazing?
Like going back to that warm, euphoric feeling. Like they just stopped hitting me with the baseball bat for a couple of hours, and it just felt awesome.
Yeah, I can relate to that too. There's a lovely immediacy. You just say things. They are recorded. Occasionally, you might worry if you've massively screwed something up, and it's preserved for posterity. You have to make your peace with that. But just there is a lot of love in our little studio when there's three, sometimes four, of us there all just bouncing off one another, occasionally going one another, but generally doing it for the love of cinema and finding things to champion. I mean, we pick the films we cover each week. Occasionally it backfires. We pick something that later we regret devoting any oxygen to at all. But for the most part, we're doing it because we want to, I suppose, it's the bottom line.
Yeah, and perhaps also, as critics, we're already having these conversations with each other, and so why not get together and formalise the kinds of conversations that we have?
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant point, because Andy created the Political Gap Fest entirely on that theory, that they would have, that the political reporters and editorialists at Slate Magazine would get on a phone call and informally throw around the day's news and opinions about it. And it was loose, it was very candid, it was profane. And someone, a light bulb went off over someone's head and they said, well, this is what would make a good political chat show. Mm.
It's incredible how influential GabFest has been, not just in the number of panelists, because I did a podcast last year too, not about culture, but it had three people and we did finish on recommendations. And I think that format has been, I mean, copied,
it will outlive
plagiarized.
Us all.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Now you've talked a bit about the love that and of the text and the engagement with your panelists that keeps you coming back. But in terms of having to keep up with the weekly cultural world, I think of other podcasts and other review videos that are out there on YouTube and so on that sometimes have the luxury of just picking kernels from, you know, culture historically, and whether you feel bound by that immediacy in your all your podcasts, which do engage with what's happening now.
I mean, because we, you know, we have the three topics, as it seems the whole world does, we try to have a mix every week. And that's something that over the years, you know, now 9 years of having conference calls and deciding what to talk about that week has become kind of clear. You just instinctually know, well, there's the big obvious thing, right? It might not always be a blockbuster thing, but it's the big thing that's happening that week. You know, it might be the Olympic opening ceremony or something, but what everyone will be talking about that week. And then we really try to have what we call, and then, whoops, the second topic might be a television show or an article, but there's this elusive third topic category that is precisely that. And once in a while, we'll deliberately go non-ephemeral, you know. We'll say, like, let's just randomly reach back into history and all watch a classic film together, you know, or all read, we haven't done this, but something like read Virginia Woolf's Room of One's Own and talk about it. And I really love those topics. Well, actually, the Abstract Nouns edition that you referred to, which is one of our more popular episodes ever, is completely non-current, has nothing to do with current events, and it's just all about language. We chose just three different language-related topics, and now I can't remember, but it was something like, you know, punctuation.
Finding voice. And yeah, I can't remember the third one, but I spent the whole time just taking notes. And then, yeah, feeling like I should be a mute. So, Steve, what about you? Do you feel sometimes that you wish you could draw on historical texts more? I mean, you do it quite a bit already, but do you feel tired by the now?
You definitely feel as though you are on the receiving end of waves of ephemera. And what I find, and I'd be curious to hear the reaction of non-Americans in the room, but what I find about American popular culture is it comes at you with an enormous amount of self-importance and swagger, and as if you have to think about it, like some portion of your mental life has to be devoted to Baywatch or to Dwayne The Rock Johnson or whatever.
And even more insulting, we do it to the whole world, you know? We're impinging this garbage on everyone. Anyway, go on.
So, but what's bizarre about the business model is that that can be a six-month publicity run-up to something whose, you know, commercial fortunes are made in the opening weekend, and often by 8 p.m. on Friday night, they can algorithmically extrapolate how much money it's going to make globally. And then there's another wave the following week, and behind that wave has been its own six-month lead-up. So it's this bizarre thing where it's, like, huge and pompous. The actual thing itself is juvenile and forgettable, and then it, by the necessity of the business model, has to be swept aside for the next thing that comes in. And so finding your own moral and intellectual balance at the center of those waves of ephemera, I think, is something you almost have to do as an American, whether you're a critic or not a critic. And to the extent that the rest of the world has been turned into involuntary Americans by our cultural imperialism, you have to do it too. So if our podcast plays any role in, you know, like, we're swimming in it incoherently, and we're just trying to extract a set of coherent narratives that we're in charge of, right, as opposed to the marketing departments of the major media companies in the United States. That leads me to a second point, which is that over time, you begin to see these totally unexpected patterns of what gets caught in your net over time. And those accretions become things that we return to over and over again and talk about repeatedly. I mean, it's the arc of a particular director's career would be an obvious one, but also, I mean, Dana, maybe jump in, but there are just certain, you know, aspects of university life in America, or free speech, or, you know, a set of, you know, obviously feminism and identity politics, but over and over and over again. And those begin to take on a weight and an importance through repetition that hasn't been dictated to you by a PR flack.
And that to me seems to me to be a kind of provisional victory.
I think also the fact that the podcast sticks around, you know, it will stay around long after the actual text that it's talking about has vanished and the next and the next and the next have come up, means that you can maybe sometimes wait a little to discuss something that you think might have lasting value beyond the opening weekend. So, for instance, we really, really wanted to talk about I Love Dick, the TV adaptation on the rereaders, but we're thinking to ourselves, it'll still be around. People are still reading the book. Because it's a streaming show, they can still get around to streaming it. It's not like having to rush out to the opening day of a film that's going to be out of cinemas in a week. So for us as well, we try and fight back against what Stephen's talking about, the involuntary Americanism. We quite strongly always have at least one Australian topic on the rereaders, and it's sometimes a topic that might have fallen by the wayside because we get so caught up in those waves of ephemera. For instance, an Australian film that might get overshadowed by a Hollywood film, or an Australian book that people might be ignoring in favour of the latest sort of buzzy US book. So for me, the podcast is the format that makes that kind of thing really doable.
And it gives your podcast an identity as well that you,
well, that's
you've
right.
come
yeah.
to
I mean,
stand for.
If everyone's talking about the latest releases, then what separates you? I mean, first of all, of course, it's your critical eye, what you bring to it. But secondly, it's your choice of topics, you know. I hope that people listen to the rereaders thinking not only that we'll have a different take. God, I hate that word take, by the way. But it's become the orthodoxy, hasn't it? But
we just
also
got your take on take.
Yeah, lol. but also that what we choose to look at is valuable too. That's our critical eye.
Cerise?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, from week to week, we are mindful of what is about to be released, but also how long we think anything might be in circulation in cinemas here, and whether we feel it might benefit from a boost that we entertain the notion of that we're capable of giving just through being one of very few outlets that might grant some critical attention to a film that looks like it's got an extremely narrow window release at perhaps one cinema in town, but we really want to get behind that film, even if we suspect sometimes there's an ulterior motivation behind the release of that film into the cinema for, say, the 1 week. Like some Australian films need that, though, to be eligible for the awards at the end of the year, the industry awards. Other times there's something that we know has been running the festival circuit in the lands far beyond Australia that we know is worthy of attention but is going to just slip through the cracks, because the cracks have never really been bigger here, in as much as there's no one on free-to-air television that I'm aware of, especially giving the real critical focus to cinema. Am I right, Mel? There isn't, is there?
Well, I mean, everyone still harks back to At the Movies.
Yes.
With, David Stratton and
it's
Margaret
It's been a few
Pomerantz.
Years now, it's gone.
I know, but it's still held up as this touchstone, and there's always been this talk of reviving it. Who will be the new David and Margaret is the constant talk in Australia. But, I mean, now a lot of that conversation has moved to web shows, to second channels. There isn't really a broadcast critical view, so I think you are right, Cerise.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the statistics are terrifying. I think there's as many as one full-time critic in the nation presently, is that right? What, is Jason DeRosso at the ABC might be the only...
Yeah, the thing is that while people are associated with particular mastheads, what might not be immediately obvious to the audience, the readership, is that they're just freelancers like anyone and their job is so precarious.
They're desperate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so that's why I think more and more critics are choosing to self-identify rather than to identify with mastheads, because they understand that you can move around from place to place, and so it's your critical view that should be valued.
So the defunding of these kind of marquee critic roles at many outlets, combined with social media, which I know you all use, and then also combined with what you were talking about, Cerise, where you think the time for the monolithic review has at least reached, you know, gone over its hump, if you like. So how do all those things play into the act of podcasting?
Well, I think people... Well, I like to think people enjoy hearing a conversation rather than just a single voice. And I like to think that...
aren't there just more of those single voices, is what I'm saying. Aren't you all just self-appointing to that monolithic or, you know, finding an audience?
Yeah, well, it's through a whole different channels. I mean, we're never going to get quite the same reach as Margaret and David ever did in their heyday, I shouldn't think. But on the other hand, no one has to look at us like they had to with them. We're just these voices which people can project whatever they wish to upon. Aside from when we turn up at public events like this and blow people's minds.
Even so, it's voluntary for the audience. You pick and choose who your favourites are, and there's not the sense of, for instance, at The Age being Melbourne's newspaper for a certain kind of reader. They will read the critic who happens to be working for The Age. But nowadays it's becoming much more opt-in in terms of where you get your criticism from. So, of course, yes, we are all on social media, but hopefully people are following us and keeping up with the conversations that we have because they find them valuable rather than just because they're there.
I have to say that a lot of the film critics that I follow on film Twitter, as they say, I have no idea what main publication they're associated with because the channel that I find them is, I just follow them, right? Mm-hmm. I want to hear their voice wherever they may be freelancing or whatever publication they may be bouncing between. Mm. And I hope, I mean, I haven't done much bouncing. I've been at Slate for more than 10 years as a movie critic, but I hope people feel the same way about me, that I'm sort of, you know, a portable critic in some ways.
Yeah, I think what's hard to tell is how many people are actually seeking us out, though. Previously, people would simply find criticism in the pages of a broadsheet, or they would use the national broadcaster and switch on at a regular time every week, and it would just be there, and it would be in their lounge, and it was just a given that people engaged with this. Now people do have to seek us out, and we have to somehow find ways to bring attention to ourselves to make that easier for them. Mm. And then, of course, there are so many voices out there in that new media landscape. So quite how to maximise our reach, I don't know, especially as I work with three others who are all in a community radio environment. So we don't have a budget for publicity or any fancy schmancy stuff like that. We've just got to sort of work at social media. It's a whole new, well, it's not especially new paradigm, but it's a very different paradigm. Yeah.
Steve, do your views, and Dana, I'd be curious whether your views on the show about something get torn down for on social media, and that kind of engagement comes back into the podcast?
I don't know about Stephen. I mean, I feel like we have some pretty gentle, loving following. You know, of course, I'm more likely to get trashed through Slate than through, I mean, they're through my reviews for Slate than for the podcast itself.
They're gentle and loving to you, Dana. I'm a magnet for immense reservoirs of hostility.
I mean, part of my use of social media is that I just will not fight on social media. It's a complete waste of time, and it just brings down the whole public discourse. And as soon as something starts to turn into a back and forth about, you know, if somebody has an actual correction to issue or says, like, I was deeply offended by what you said and they have a point, then I'll engage with them once, but no back and forth.
Are you sure you're not a Canadian?
I think kind of tying into what the theme that was being played upon a minute ago, you know, the idea of the singularly authoritative critical voice writing for a venerable broadsheet ex-cathedra pronouncing an opinion on a cultural product, and it kind of stands alone. Obviously, that's over, and that's played into, I think, the hostility that I receive on the show, because in fact, I'm kind of playing it's like an act of minstrelsy in a way. Like, I'm kind of playing this pompous person who thinks his opinions ought to prevail, and I'm like just self-aware enough to know that it's an anachronism and a little bit of an act of play acting. But I do think that that's why I become a magnet for a certain kind of hostility, is that I come in using that voice. But I think a couple of things have changed in the 9 years since we started doing the podcast. The first is that I had kids, and the idea that you speak univocally and angrily at everything that disappoints you just goes out the freaking window if you're human at all. And I've just been so softened by being a parent that I find it hard, Dana, to savage things on a week-by-week basis. I've ended up liking everything, and I think it's turned off our audience. And then the second thing is streaming television is a revolution that's happened completely concurrent with our podcast. And now, on a weekly basis, it's almost impossible not to find something that's ridiculously beautifully produced, you know, meticulously written, carefully written with wit and soul. I also think, and I think these things are related, is leading up to 2008, you could really argue there'd been a 30-plus year period in American life of essentially credit bubble to credit bubble, a lot of very easy money, and a kind of studied and sort of self-conscious callousness and arrogance that went along with that. And when 08 cratered the whole thing and the pretense was really lost and hasn't really been recovered, I do actually think the default mode of popular culture now is at least a higher degree of empathy than it was prior to 08. So interestingly, I actually think it's become harder to be a kind of pompous, perennially disappointed highbrow since 08, but I'm trying.
Oh, good best. For you. So I think, having said that, that there is greater empathy in the tenor of some debate, there's also obviously the, I guess, the kind of angry mode that you see in social media. And I want you to perhaps, something I've reflected on is one of the reasons I hate having negative discussions with people on social media is everything is written there that you've previously said. Mm-hmm. So then you feel a need to go back and defend that exact thing, whereas in conversation there is room for modality and change and, whether that is something that you found, you know, yourself changing through, your views changing through the podcasting practice.
Hmm. I don't know. I'm not quite sure how to answer
like,
that.
Do you walk away from a podcast having been like, oh, Baywatch was terrible, and then afterwards, oh, maybe there was something
to
be said for it.
Yeah. And in fact, we've kind of created a category, a niche that we return to once in a while called esprit d'escalier, right? The French expression for the wit of the staircase, as they say, deciding on the way out of the building that you should have said something different. And once in a while, we'll have an esprit d'escalier segment where we just rethink completely a segment on something. Yeah, but I mean, Mel's right that it's out there. You know, once you've taped it, it's going to be out there in the stratosphere, and you can have it thrown back in your face at any point.
I find that in the course of the conversation that you're doing in the podcast episode, you might even be changing your opinion. I've known myself to come to the discussion prepared to be very forceful in one way or another, but finding myself manoeuvred cunningly by my co-hosts into a much more moderate position, or conversely, converting them more towards my perspective than they were prepared to at the beginning of the discussion. So I think the conversational mode of it can moderate some of those extreme opinions. And also I think that when you're talking about how you don't really get very much pushback in terms of meanness, maybe it's because they can hear human voices and they understand that there are real people doing some thinking through rather than pronouncing from on high their finished opinions. It's a review in progress, really. A podcast.
Yeah, I totally agree with everything you just said. I always feel that we're winging it on a when we're in doing this thing live each time. We don't go in for any post-production. It's so the podcast is what was said in the moment. And so I feel each of us soften regularly in our views as we hear each other out, occasionally, of course, pausing to interrupt the other person before fully hearing them out. But there is definitely a dialogue. And I think it certainly enriches my appreciation of anything we're discussing. I like to think that that is transmitted to anyone listening as well. Certainly it means more perspectives employed in critiquing a film. And oftentimes that comes with different knowledge that each of us has of, it could be industrial elements in the production of the film or precedents for this film from involving the personnel or involving a previous film, which this references that one of us picked up on, the others didn't, or all manner of different ways to flesh out the significance of any given film, or insignificance, as occasionally turns out to be the case.
Steve?
Can I just say, for the record, that live to air, that's fucking gangster. I mean, just huge props for that. I mean, the number of retakes that we do in recording our show.
It's true. Any impression that we have any kind of wit or structure in what we're saying is completely due to our producers.
It's all in post.
Well, this is why I never listen back to the podcast.
Oh, my God. Right. I've never heard mine. One time.
Well, just on that, which episodes, which phrases, which reviews on the podcast do you listen back to over the years and think, God, that was tone deaf?
Well, Steve never listens. It's almost a superstition with him. I think his fear is that he would not be able to do it anymore if he ever heard himself.
I would sooner cut off my own head than listen to 5 minutes of...
I occasionally make myself listen because I think you know, I want to know how something came off, or I'm uneasy about it, or I want to know how to improve it, but I don't enjoy listening, unless I'm not on the show. I love the weeks when I'm out of town and I can hear what the podcast is. At those moments, I can sort of imagine why we have a following, whereas the weeks that I'm on it, as I was saying to Stephen, I'm sort of baffled that all this has happened and don't know how we got as many listeners as we did. But then when you hear
it
you're not on the show.
What is it, 6 million or something?
I don't have the exact numbers. Oh, wait, per week, no. I think per week we have something like 150,000 downloads or something like that. But who knows? It's hard to know of those downloads who listens till the end, you know, who is a regular listener.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Steve, you've never listened back, but are there things you've gotten out of the studio and thought, maybe I shouldn't have said that?
Oh, my God. My whole life is spent wincing with regret at what I just said over and over again. And also, I do this thing where I scroll through my daily transcript mentally often in the middle of the night and then sit bolt upright, marveling at the inane thing that I said. I went on the wonderful, I'm going to not remember exactly its name, but is it Triple R? On their morning show yesterday. I had so much fun. And not only was I introduced to Jeff Sparrow, I knew his byline from The Guardian, and I was convinced at 2 a.m. that I'd called him James in the middle of the segment. So I follow him on Twitter, wait for him. I'm like sitting there refreshing until he bumps me back, follows me back. And I'm like, holy shit, did I go? And he's like, no. you called me Jeff. Like, and now he thinks I'm a fucking psycho. So,
I doubt that.
Does that answer your question?
Mel, any?
Oh, well, look, I listen to every episode when it first comes out because I just want to see how did it go. But then usually after that first listen, I don't go back. I usually, as we walk out of the studio having just recorded it, have this vibe about, oh, that went well, or, oh, that was a loose one. but the weird thing is, even those times where I think that it was loose, whether it's something that I, you know, was projecting onto it, or whether it's the magic of our producer, it always comes out okay to me.
Mm.
But of course, I'm exactly like Stephen with all the like angst and the did I say that wrong? It's just a dreadful way to go through life.
Okay, so in that, I guess the flip of being self-loathing about everything is that imagine that you are the benevolent dictator of the podcast and you get to make everyone talk about your niche interest for 40 minutes every week. What would that be?
Wow. I wouldn't want us to talk about only what I want to talk about or just one thing per week, but I think there are some areas that are undercovered on our show that I would like to talk about more, not areas of expertise for me at all, but just, you know, things that I might be more passionate about. I wish that we talked more about classical music and just non-Western, non-pop music in general, that we were open to a bigger musical world, and we would probably need to get guests on to do that a lot because none of us know that much about it. But that's something I might bring to the show. That's all that comes to mind right now for me. Steve, what is it? What do you think is something that's undercovered that you'd like us to talk about more?
Oh, my God. That's a
or
really
you could
question.
Do the benevolent dictator format, either or.
I would say, I think it would be interesting to talk about, like step back and talk about ideas in a way that I think is very hard to find a format, you know, appropriate format for. Just as one example, there's a, in American politics right now, there's a large kind of beneath the surface, but constantly now erupting debate about the relationship between, essentially, I mean, it was Hillary versus Bernie, right? What the nature of the left is going to be going forward. And as one part of that argument, there's a question about whether there are modes of solidarity that are completely transcendent of identity categories, right? So like some slightly refurbished notion of socialism about, you know, kind of universal healthcare, universal rights, like basically a universalistic language of rights and duties of a citizen versus identity politics, right? Like, in a, you know, you hardly need me to tell you that in the United States there are historically disesteemed categories of people who've been roundly abused and denigrated by American society, and the attempt to make them equal partners in the American experiment has been a centuries-old project. Like, what are the relationship between those two things? And in that sense, like, there are moments when I wish we were a culture podcast in a slightly larger sense, and like, what is the capital C culture really going through and trying to get at through ideas that are not yet fully articulated, but there is no effing way I'm going to get any of what I just said past Juliet Cerner. She would have shut me down 40 words ago and said, yeah, fine, that, you could sing that song in the shower in the morning.
Well, I mean, what she would have said was, yes, let's talk about all that, but we have to frame it through an object, yeah, a cultural object.
Yeah, we have to peg it to Baywatch. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, that sounds fascinating to me. But, of course, I would also like it to be pegged to an object. Because objects, I guess, are texts, how I sort of make sense of the world. And so even when we try and have a more abstract discussion on rereaders, we usually peg it to an article that's come out recently, for instance. But, look, I wish that I could get the other guys to talk more about robots. It's my pet topic. And artificial intelligence, machine learning. Oh, yeah. I wanted to have a topic about, there's this Google thing where you do a little drawing and the AI guesses what you just drew.
Yeah.
And I think that that's so interesting but also terrifying. But, of course, it's hard to talk about visual objects or visual processes almost like that on a podcast. But,
Slate recently did the face
app. We talked about face app. Yeah, that's, I mean, that when I talk about the third topic, you know, the sort of oddball thing, face app is one of those things. And one of the ways that we handle the fact that it is visual is that we just played with it on air. You know,
all
of us sort of sent each other our faces and in different genders and ages and reacted to them in real time.
Well, the great thing about this Google thing is that you've got a little voice guessing. It's a fish. No, it's a bolt. No, it's a, I don't know what that is. So maybe it might be fun to play with
it.
But I felt very aggrieved that it didn't recognise my beautiful art. Anyway, I'm just really interested in those technology side of things, topics.
Yeah, and for my part, I mean, we're a cinema podcast, so we're not going to go too far afield. But cinema, so dating back to 1895, there's a fair bit to cover. Only cover as many or as few as three films or film-like things a week. There's quite a bit of catch-up to do. So,
yeah.
And I mean, I think it'd be pretty dull for almost everyone else here if I were just to spout off a list of filmmakers or film movements that I'd like to cover in the course of, let's say, the next 30 years at least that is necessary just to get between 1895 and maybe 1905. So it's a big old world of cinema, let alone trying to grapple with robotics,
well,
AI,
any
and
themes?
Everything you said just before. Yeah.
Are there any themes that you would
themes?
Yeah, look at that you don't.
Well, can
know?
I ask a question quickly? How often do you? What's the balance between older movies and fresh releases?
The older movies come up if there's a season. For example, right now there's a retrospective of Akira Kurosawa films the Australian Centre for the Moving Image. So the show's been covering a Kurosawa film each the last couple of weeks. But it needs to be indexed to something, or when the Melbourne International Film Festival rolls into town for 3 months every year, it feels like. We really just hone in on the festival. So otherwise, I mean, there are tons of themes, but we do get to tease out an awful lot just based on what we're given weekly in Melbourne. We are quite spoiled, I think. A lot of people here take for granted what the diet of cinema we can enjoy here is. It's pretty good. Yeah, but over time, I think we get to play with most thematic material and we might want to, but I'm doubtless missing things. I just hope that they'll come up organically.
Okay, well, before we throw to audience questions, I will blatantly plagiarise the Slate model and ask if any of you have any criticism podcasts other than yourselves that you would like to recommend to our keen audience.
I mean, the ones I listen to are so well-known that I feel like if people here are podcast fans, they probably know them. Film Spotting is a venerable criticism podcast that's sort of on the Siskel and Ebert model. You know, two guys talk about movies of the week, and they do some interesting thematic and retrospective things as well. It's not always a brand-new movie. But a lot of the podcasts that I listen to are not specifically criticism-focused. Now I really want to listen to Plato's Cave because that's kind of, I feel like that's the film podcast I've been looking for. I don't know. I can recommend lots of podcasts, but they're
not
criticism-based.
That's all right. Anyone else want to jump in?
What about the Karina Longworth one?
Oh, Oh, of course. Yeah, I wouldn't. That's, and that's more film history. But do you all know You Must Remember This, the Carina Longworth podcast? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's just an unmissable film history podcast that's very produced. Unlike a lot of podcasts that have this extremely conversational tone, it's just one person, this one woman, Carina Longworth. She covers one topic from film history each time, often something sort of a, it's almost like a biographical essay on a particular actor or director. And really uses sound clips and music and layers in the sound in an interesting way. She's on hiatus right now, so I'm anxiously waiting the next season. But You Must Remember This is key. Thanks for that one, Steve.
Any others?
Yeah, I'd give a shout out to folks at Hell Is for Hyphenates. Comes to mind. There are local folk involved, Lee Zachariah and these days Sophie Meyer, who's London-based, and they monthly get a guest person in to pick apart the oeuvre of any or of a very particular director nominated by that guest, as well as going over a few new releases and generally doing a pretty fine job of critiquing.
And they're getting some pretty high-powered guests.
Well, they have been lately,
That's great. I have to say that one of my favourites is quite a... It's not really criticism, it's Crybaby. So it's... Mm-hmm. Have you heard Crybaby? So it's a podcast that the concept is they get a fun guest in every week. It's Susan Orlean. I've forgotten the other woman who hosts it. And they're crying cues. So they're just pieces of culture in their lives that they've consumed that make them cry and that almost... that they choose to watch when they want to cry or that always make them cry when they see a snippet of it. And they're incredible cues. They're from films through to pop music through to oration. Like one of them was Barack Obama's inauguration speech. And it's just... I think it's a really unique perspective on how we consume culture.
One of my podcasting goals is to be a guest on Cry Babies, and I would be such an easy guest because I cry in about 5 minutes at any cultural product.
AT&T commercial,
Okay, do we have any audience questions? We've got roaming mics.
My name's Maddie. A lot of you said earlier in the podcast that, in the session, that one of the things you liked about podcasting was having the freedom to do things that don't really fit in other traditional media models. And one of my favourite podcasts is one you might be familiar with called The Worst Podcast in the World, which is two New Zealand guys who, instead of reviewing different movies every week, each week review the same movie, which is Grown Ups 2, which is a terrible movie. And they've been going for about two seasons. And it's and they slowly lose their mind, and they hate this movie so much. And I love it. It's brilliant to listen to. And I was just wondering what the most interesting or fun experimental thing you've either done or heard other people do.
That's a great question.
Oh, well, I really want to get more of the production, post-production type stuff involved with the rereaders because, as it has become abundantly clear, this three-topic, three-host sort of model could do with some... sort of loosening around the edges. Every year Cinema Nova hosts a live telecast of the Oscars and all the film industry people go and watch the winners being announced. And I went this time with a Zoom recorder and my aim was to try and get people's opinions about all the winners and stuff as I was getting progressively drunker and drunker. Mm. But what I didn't realise was that there really isn't very much time to do that within the telecast. The commercial break goes for 1 minute or something, and then you're just riveted and no one wants to talk to you as well. They're like, who's winning for this thing? But I want to do more of those field recording type things on rereaders in the future. Yeah.
Great. Hello, my name's Margaret. I work for the mainstream media. I work for ABC News, and I'm just wondering whether you see... Mel's kind of touched on the role of the critic falling away from the mainstream media, I guess, really. Whether you see... how mainstream media can be involved in the future of that, if at all?
Well, I think ABC is one of the most supportive major media organisations in terms of audio. There's a wonderful team of producers across all the different levels of both radio and TV and online at the ABC. So if I were going to look to an existing media organisation, I'd probably look to them. But also there are new, very cashed-up, online-only media organisations. So, for instance, I do a lot of reviewing for Junkie.com, and they're quite innovative in how they partner with other organisations to fund some of the projects that they do. So they're doing a thing called Video Junkies up in Sydney, in which they're actually going to talk about streaming culture, which is a kind of neglected form of stuff that we look at. So I think that perhaps we could look to some of those younger and better at getting money media organisations in the future. But national broadcasters and public broadcasting in general, I think, is where it's at the moment. What do you guys think?
Oh, that sounds fairly consistent with my reckoning, in Australia at least. I don't know.
I mean, Slate's considered mainstream media, is it not?
God, it's such a neither fish nor fowl, right?
Right. I mean, yeah.
It's like its strength and its weakness.
It's sort of one of the flagship, the flagship digital magazine, but what a digital magazine is still unclear.
Still,
yeah. And as we were discussing backstage, I mean, as a film critic, there's a very clear divide in the way PR people treat you if you write for an all-digital outlet or if you write for a print outlet in terms of, you know, how early an access you're going to get to screenings and sort of how much of a VIP you are, which is really a huge mistake on their part because they're shutting out the future of media.
Yeah. I mean, to answer the question from a different, or maybe to answer a completely different question, but I think what's going to be really interesting is the demographic shift when you really get a preponderance of an audience that has lost all of the habits of media consumption that we grew up with, and how quickly and how radically major media is going to have to redefine itself, because that very concept alone is a complete turnoff to anyone under the age of 20 right now. I mean, they prefer to opt out completely. Mm. But.
So how do we do that?
I mean, one thing I would say, and maybe this is just sort of retro nostalgia, but bring back the review. You know, the movie review is always talked about as if it's this dying form, and we've all got to expand into doing profiles, and you know, it has to be some sort of thematic, you know, take, to use that word, on the larger culture. And I think there's just so much value in that venerable form of the movie review. And so, you know, I would love there to be, you know, a radio and television reviewer, somebody who's like a regular critic that people get to know their voice, the equivalent of, you know, a Roger Ebert from back in his day, that becomes this national beloved mainstream figure, you know, hopefully maybe not a white guy this time, who takes a movie, looks at it closely.
I mean, I think that that's a great idea, but I suspect that what's going to happen is there are going to be these little seedlings that are in the ground right now, and some of them have already sprouted considerably, like Vice or Vox, and they're just one day going to become the behemoths that the Times and, you know, and ABC and various other. I mean, I don't know that the way the major media companies are now organized and their whole paradigm, their whole way of looking at what they are relative to what we are, can survive habits that just, you know, that's just a complete anachronism to people under the age of 30, not to say 20. So I think like Vox is a great example of, you know, this whole other. I mean, do you guys read Vox at all, or is it just so American centric?
Yeah, I read Vox. Yep.
Right. This like really blunt, really explanatory. You were born 3 minutes ago. Let me explain it to you.
Wait, the tagline is "The news explained."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Completely stolen from Slate, by the way. But, right? The explainer. I mean, it's a Slate thing. From which Slate has moved away to some degree.
Maybe we'll be able to have reviews in a town square as a sort of a town crier type function.
Oh, my God.
To take us to the people.
Like Martin Luther tacking them up on the church door.
Well, film and album reviews are kind of like restaurant reviews in that, yes, they have been replaced by review apps, if you like, in some ways, for a lot of people. But at the same time, you still occasionally get the perfectly written review that goes completely viral in the restaurant world as in the movie world.
But it's often a savaging, right? It's often a hatchet job. I mean, that's the other thing is that people hate negativity, say they hate negativity, but the truth is they love negativity.
When it's well justified, I think.
Yeah. No, that's true.
Yeah.
No. Not necessarily, no, I think. They just love savagery, actually. People bathe of critical blood. They love it.
They're like a good catfight. Yeah.
Hello. I have a question which is kind of quite broad. I'm interested in how to empower producers, I suppose. And this is a big question for me as, you know, a podcast producer. I almost say formally now. Hi, Mel.
Hi, this is Izzy. She was the Rereaders producer and she's now the director of the Emerging Writers Festival. So podcast producers are awesome. They get great jobs.
Woo. But one thing that's really striking, so it came up a little bit in a couple of moments, like both talking about that there's so much great produced content around when you're watching streaming shows, or even Mel, what you were saying with wanting to move the Rereaders into like more highly produced territory, you have to be able to resource the producers. It's basically like time is money, And so it might take three times as long to edit out the ums and the ahs in the first place and then, you know, do something like a field recording and include that as well as, you know, music or something additional. And I guess what I'm curious about is how to, like, educate consumers and listeners about how much goes into the making of something like that. Because I think we have this idea that, like, everyone's a media maker now, everyone can download, you know, some audio editing software. Truly, yes, you can, and that's amazing. But also then how do you put a price on that? How do you find the money to make sure that people keep producing content at that level? It's a really big question. I don't know.
As someone who produced a podcast for a major media organization last year and was astonished at the hours that went into it, and it wasn't even particularly highly produced, I would say that you would struggle because of the incredible wealth of stream TV that, as you say, Steve, every week there seems to be something that is worthy of praise that is released, and we struggle to keep up with that. That people aren't looking at the machine behind that. They're just getting that content often for a very low price, $10 a month. And I empathise with your struggle, but I think when you're looking at the volume of excellent content that's out there at the moment, it's a difficult question.
I think perhaps one answer or a partial answer might be for the on-air people to, or the on-air, the mic-facing people to pay more tribute to what the producers do and to involve the producers more, to highlight this episode was produced by, you know, naming the producers and honouring what they do.
Another round for their one-year anniversary. Another round is a BuzzFeed podcast. For their one-year anniversary, they did a whole episode with their producers and it was fascinating. I highly recommend it.
We recently got our new producer, Arij, on the mic to talk about Get Out, and Izzy herself has got on the mic in the past to talk about Pokemon Go, wasn't it?
Jessica Jones.
That's right, yeah. So thinking of the producer not as just the silent, you know, slider of you know, levels, but also a participant and a creative person on the podcast as well.
You could, one week, you could just air the or post the unedited version and then no one would ever have any problem identifying their contribution to your.
I mean, the one thing I would add in praise of producers is that, you know, besides the technical expertise they bring and the taking out of the ums and ahs and layering in of music and clips and all of that stuff, they're an incredibly important sort of third party, you know, they're just an outside ear, right? I mean, if you produced yourself, even if we had, which we don't at all, the technical knowledge to produce ourselves, we wouldn't have that side of like what a great line editor is for a writer, you know, someone who's able to stand outside and say, and shape it and say, what are you trying to do here? What's the overall goal of this segment? You know, how can we work toward making it better? Mm-hmm. We couldn't do that without our producer and our intern. I mean, it all happens not in front of the mic.
Totally agree. That is the single most important function of a producer. We've had many of them over the years. And yeah, the sound judgment of a producer is way, way more important than anything
else. It's literally sound judgment.
There we go. There's a podcast title.
That's a great name for a podcast about producers. Sound judgment. Somebody take it.
All right. I have one last question, which is, as I think all of you except Sarissa write is primarily, is that right? Yeah. So how podcasting has affected your writing?
Wow. I've never thought about that. Have you, Stephen?
If at all, it doesn't have to have.
I mean, I kind of agree with what Stephen
says,
that there's kind of a gulf between the two, in that, I mean, as I said at the very beginning of our conversation, podcasting feels more like a place of freedom and lightness and the way conversation is, you know, and writing happens in this horrible mental silo where, as Stephen once said, you're face to face with the stupidest, least articulate version of yourself, you know, for hours on end. So maybe the only
devastating.
But maybe the only relationship I can come up with right now is that as Stephen said, podcast is kind of an escape and a place that you can experience ideas as something to play with and throw around, you know, as opposed to something that, oh God, you know, I have to order and structure these and make them somehow coherent on the page.
Does it inspire your writing in any way, the perspectives or the the thoughts that come to you in the podcast?
Sometimes.
Do you write more conversationally?
Normally, though, if there's a movie that I'm reviewing and we're podcasting on it, I will have already filed the review by the time we're podcasting. So normally it happens the other way, you know, that I'm bringing something from the review into the conversation. I don't know about how does it work with you?
Sometimes it's either or. I've already filed my review, or we might be talking about it and I'm still working frantically on the review, sending those groveling emails to my editor. It's coming soon. I find that maybe the conversational aspect of podcasting, which I know I've returned to a few times in the last hour, maybe helps me get out of my own head and that feeling of the silo that comes from just sitting there by yourself trying to figure out what you think about something. It's refreshing to bounce off other people. And maybe this is a bad confession for a reviewer, but I sometimes read other people's reviews to help me figure out what I think. I don't, you know, avoid other people's reviews.
I seldom write reviews of new releases or so on. I occasionally write sort of more academic writing in a way for journals, but and that has its own vocabulary, but I'm given to waffly, flowery, purple prose at the best of times on air or with the written word. So I don't know how one influences the other, but I expect it does in ways that are mysterious and perhaps helpful. I don't know. I am not self-aware enough to have dwelt upon that, and not about to right now because we've run out of time. It's a shame.
We have run out of time. Okay, well, an apt end. Thank you all. And let's give our panellists, Cerise, Steve, Mel and Dana, a big round of applause.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.